Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Thunder and Lightning by Christopher Nuttall and Leo Champion. Narrated by Jeffrey Kafer. Prologue. It is unwise to summon what you cannot dismiss. Neil Gaiman. There are known knowns. These are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we don't know we don't know. Donald Rumsfeld. Fact. The first public demonstration of wireless telegraphy was carried out by Alexander Muirhead and Professor Oliver Lodge in the lecture theater of the Oxford University Museum of Natural History on August 14, 1894. Fact. Radio waves travel at the speed of light. Fact. In 2018, the radio signals will have reached 224 light-years into space. Fact. There are 33 stars within 12.5 light-years of Earth. Fact. There are approximately 260,000 stars within 250 light-years of Earth. Fact. Every hour, the radio signals travel an additional 1,079,252,848.8 kilometers from Earth. Unknown. Who's listening? And what do they think of us? Chapter 1. Discovery. Selene Observatory, Lunar Surface. The massive dish antennae of the Lunar Observatory towered above Samar Hussein as she made her way carefully around, with only her suit's own lights and faint star glow to see by. Here on the far side, the dark side of the moon, you never saw Earth rising, or the sun's light reflected. That was why the observatory was there. With its scientists, it was shielded by millions of tons of lunar rock from Earth's endless cacophony of electromagnetic noise. Free of any terrestrial appearance, the far side was the perfect site from which to examine the stars. Samra had, as one of the first few hundred children to have been born on the moon, grown up near enough to one of Brightside's political fault lines that she appreciated her observatory's neutrality. By international, and now interplanetary, law, it belonged not to any government, faction, or corporation, but to the independent International Astronomical Union. "Boss, are you all right?" came a signal through her laser communicator. It had flickered from one of the relay points, carefully positioned well away from the ultra-sensitive radio equipment. Its own radio interference was a problem the observatory had always taken steps to avoid. Somers stepped a little back away from the massive radio dish. "I'm fine," she said. When she'd taken this post, she'd insisted that all her staff take frequent walks on the lunar surface. That didn't mean they liked it. Some Earthborn in the big colonies refused to go out, even with careful supervision. Her people did as directed, but not all of them were comfortable with their boss coming out here. While John was on the line, though, she asked, "Is there any update on the supply shipment from Orbit 7?
"None,"
the administrator replied, his voice reflecting her own irritation. Nearly 150 years since mankind had taken its first fumbling steps into space, it was still expensive to bring much up from the surface. Lunar colonists were supplied, for most of their needs, with goods made on the moon or in the zero-gravity factories orbiting Earth. For political reasons, the observatory had to split its purchases across every possible supplier, showing preference to none. It was a tremendous pain. Items the observatory could easily obtain from nearby on the moon, instead sometimes had to come all the way from lower Earth orbit. "Last word," he went on, "was that they were having production difficulties. We'll see the supplies in, I quote, round 20 days. Somers sighed as she began to pace toward the observatory's second dish set. Between dealing with power-seeking bureaucrats and directing astronomers clueless in even the basic facts of her profession, there were times she wondered why she stayed in this post. A look up toward the stars, a steady glow of millions of them across the sky, reminded her, where else could you see such sights? As a young adult, she'd heard an urban legend that Neil Armstrong, while taking humanity's first steps upon the moon, had heard the Adhan, the Islamic call to prayer. She'd been walking alone on the stark lunar landscape since childhood, and had never herself heard the Adhan. But this vast specter of silent stars amused her at times. Perhaps somewhere amidst them, Allah was still watching over his children.
"Tell them that if the delivery doesn't happen within 20, she said, "we'll take our trade elsewhere."
That wasn't quite an empty threat. If she made enough of a fuss or showed enough gain for the IAU, the bureaucrats would back her up. The problem would be showing enough gain to them. The observatory, spread out across nearly 200 square kilometers across ground near the center of Darkseid, was hers. Or almost hers. The IAU had appointed her and would someday replace her. But until then, she was queen of all she surveyed. Not least because the current arrangement of a lunar-born running the observatory benefited everyone. Certain internet discussion forums had already raised the question of just who it belonged to. If Carl Bova eventually did manage to put forward his mandate for lunar independence, it would be hard to avoid the fact that the observatory itself was on lunar territory. Of course, she thought grimly, that would almost certainly start a war. It had been years since the formative events of lunar history, the Lawton Rebellion, the Han Pact, and so on. But as the moon became better populated and more important to those inhabitants than Earth, it was hard for even an apolitical scientist like Samra to see how the status quo could remain. If the Lunar Independence Front ever actually managed to win control of a significant number of lunar colonies, that wasn't a day she was looking forward to. The moon was like Earth in some ways, but all it took was a leak in your pressure suit to remind you of the differences. "Has anything else happened that I should know about?" she asked. "No, boss," John Laud said in his British accent. "Nothing too important." He was Earthborn, from the British Commonwealth itself. Although the British lunar colony of Albion was only 500 miles from the observatory, several of the installation's emergency plans relied on Albion's help. There was also a small military base, in theory present for security against Lawton terrorists. In practice, as everyone knew, it was really there against the day another of the great powers launched a land grab. "A small set of updates from the LEO tracking system, that's all." Samara glanced at the display projected in front of her eyes and the lower part of her field of vision. She still had an hour before she'd start to run out of air, plenty of time to complete the inspection. The Reform Islam practiced by the Caliphate colony where she'd grown up had adopted the principle of Allah helps those who help themselves. She'd never been very devout, but she understood the lesson. All Lunarborn did. "Very well," she said. "Inform me if anything changes." She turned her attention back to the path in front of her. It had been clearly marked out years ago by the original construction crews. Lunar history was filled with tales of people who'd paid with their lives for forgetting they were on what was in fact an extremely hostile world. There were just so many things that could go wrong. So she saw only a handful of other workers as she completed her inspection around the vast dish arrays, although there were dozens of small robots active. Farside was oddly oppressive, even to her. Most places on the moon always had radio chatter and the internet. Here, radio was banned except for emergencies. The tiniest signal interference this close to the massively sensitive radio telescopes would make them convulse in seizures. The IAU would not appreciate the cost of having to repair multi-billion credit equipment. Her communicator lit up again, with the icon that meant an urgent call across the laser network the observatory used instead of local radio. It had far, far less bandwidth than any radio network had, but all it needed was voice capability. "Yes?" she snapped. "What's happening now?"
"Director," said Tony Jones.
Her deputy's voice was taut and grim.
"I think you should come back in, at once."
Sommer didn't hesitate. Jones was something of a cold fish, unusual on the moon, but a good worker who knew his business. Angling for her job when she left or was pushed out, he'd probably have handled the matter on his own if he could have. That he was calling her inside meant a very good reason to do so.
"On my way," she replied as she headed quickly. Few people ran on the moon, but with experience you could walk fast, towards one of the access points. Most of the observatory, like all but the older lunar colonies, was underground. "Have a briefing ready for me as soon as I reach the command center. Heading there now." Its entire staff numbered less than 300, but the builders had dug deep to accommodate them and their supplies and prepare for possible emergencies. Sommer could have hosted without trouble 10 times as many people as were there. The elevator she rode downwards felt welcoming, but then it always had, and not just in comparison to the stark hostility of the surface. The observatory's facilities had to appeal to the staff to avoid a high turnover rate. She'd spent too much time dealing with contractors who disliked their facilities or family members resenting the installation's dedication to pure science. At the bottom of the elevator, airlocks hissed and she stepped out. She stripped off her pressure suit. Below it, she wore a standard lunar-style jumpsuit with soft boots. A tech moved to collect the suit while she headed for the command center. It was a spacious room of terminals, consoles, and large screens on the walls. But right now, Jones and several others, who should have been at different stations, were gathered with interest around a little used console on the wall. Had something gone wrong with one of the bridge ships, the message bearer? "Report," she snapped. "What the hell is going on?" Jones looked oddly deflated, but said, "I think we've just earned our budget for the next decade. Take a look." As Samra went over to the console, Jones hit a button to show her an overview. The Selene Observatory had been given the best deep space tracking equipment money could buy, which had led to another dispute between the IAU and the Great Powers. The Powers hadn't liked any international organizations having the ability to look out into deep space. There were rumors of secret deep space bases and testing grounds. A tracking station like the observatory could well manage to follow a craft to its hidden base. The prominence of satellites and probes with similar sensors kept the observatory out of the public eye, because tracking along Fusion Burn was easy. The image in front of Sommer refused to make sense. "Merciful Allah, what the hell is that?" Jones looked down at Rebecca Hawthorne, who flushed. "Director, I was running a basic overview when the system reported the presence of a fusion light in an unexplored region of space," she stammered. Sommer let her speak. Unexplored didn't even begin to cover the region Rebecca was talking about. "The fusion burn seemed far too large to be creditable, so I ran some checks, and they confirmed the presence of a series of fusion burns well outside the solar area, but coming toward us." Rebecca's voice broke off. Samra felt her blood run cold. Could it be? Jones's own voice was inhumanly calm as he said, "I ordered a sweep of that region, collated the data from our own telescopes and the data dumps we get from the other stations in Leo. I had the computers run predictive curves, check the results against images we've recorded over the past few months. We've double-checked everything and..." He hit another control. A cold image of deep space materialized on the console screen. Hundreds of tiny starlights studded across it. A moment later, Jones hit another key and the computer highlighted. Easily 100 lights. Ones that weren't stars, but something else. "Aliens," Sommer breathed. "Other than one of the black colonies somehow building that fleet and stockpiling enough helium-3 to fuel it, and just incidentally we ran a spectroscopic scan and we can't identify the mine that fleet's fuel came from, there is no other explanation," said Jones. His voice was still cold, inhumanly cold for a time like this. "There's an alien fleet coming to Earth." Summer's heart was in her chest, her head spinning. "Don't you understand?" she exhaled. "This changes everything." Her deputy gave a snort. "It won't change a thing. You know how our political overlords think. They'll try using the aliens as a means to pressure the spacers and the colonies to toe Earth's line and stay away from independence. A week after the announcement of this makes it out, and that's if our lords and masters even bother to tell the little people, there'll be 1 million soldiers on the moon." "Director," Rebecca coughed lightly, "I'm not convinced their fusion tech is even similar to ours. At this range, the results are far more precise. But it looks like their energy efficiency is far higher than ours. Given the power of their burns, I'm pretty certain they're somehow achieving far higher fusion rates." She stopped suddenly. Sommer rested a dark hand on the technician's shoulder to calm her. "It's okay," she said. "How many others would have seen this?" "Given the power of those burns," Rebecca said, "it's quite possible that other monitoring stations might have picked them up." There weren't many sensors pointed in that general direction, but most stations tried to maintain a watch on as much of the sky as they could. "The Rockrat stations around Freeport are in a good position to watch from that direction, and they have the sensors, too," she went on. "They're almost certain to see them within a week, if they haven't already." "That makes sense," Summer said. "Tony, we have to inform the IAU before Freeport steals all the credit." "A word?" Jones said. "In your office, ma'am?" She allowed him to steer her towards her office, which was large but sparsely decorated. 2 doctorates hung framed among the degrees on her wall. "Director, Samra, we have to tell everyone." Samra closed her eyes for a long moment, gathering her thoughts. When she opened them again, Jones was pacing back and forth on the office's smooth rock floor, his pale face flush with excitement. This was a side of the man she'd never seen, and she was intrigued by it. "It's not as if the IAU could keep this secret for long," she said. She went to the terminal at her desk and quickly brought up on the office's primary wall screen, a mirror of the terminal's image showing the lights. "There are at least 100 craft there, maybe more, and they're pumping out a lot of energy. If this continues and they get closer, every spacecraft with the crudest detectors will see them, and then..."
"The secret will be out and too late," Jones concluded. "And what happens when the Security Council decides that the best way to greet them will be with armed force?"
"We don't know what they actually want," she said. "They must be aware of our existence, but how do we assume they're friendly?"
"Interplanetary war seems hard enough," said Jones dryly. "Interstellar war?"
"In 6 months, we might learn how hard it is,"
Salmer said, and scowled at having fallen into the trap of arguing a viewpoint she didn't really believe. She'd wondered for years whether there was other intelligent life out there, but if there were, they seemed well hidden. 100 years of endless listening for alien signals had yielded nothing. But surely they wouldn't be warlike.
"I told you," she said with a very slight edge to her voice. "They can't keep it a secret forever in any case."
"Long enough to start a war because they think it'll give them a political advantage," said Jones. "Samra, if..."
She could tell what he was thinking. Lunar politics were a powder keg. The colonists had rebelled before against the governments and corporations that had established them.
Some great powers had established limited democracies to pacify their colonists. Others, like the Chinese, had simply used brute force. Now that a united lunar identity was starting to form across the various colonies, the Lunar Independence Front was gaining real support, and a lot of attention from the powers in charge of the colonies. The situation was getting to where all it would need to explode was a spark.
"You have an open mandate to announce any discovery you deem to be of great significance," Jones reminded her softly.
"Announce it. They can hardly blame you for following the procedures they gave you."
Samra finally nodded. "I'll send out the bulletin," she said. "You might want to pretend you don't know me."
If she played her cards right, she thought as she sat down at her console, she might be one of the people to make first contact. She'd always dreamed of meeting aliens. How might Allah's other children appear to her eyes?
Joan shut the door behind him. She began to write up the bulletin, thinking of just how much the solar system had changed. Alien contact in her lifetime.
Chapter 2. The Never-Ending War. Western Exclusion Zone, Africa.
"Missiles launched," came over the radio to Captain Christopher Fardell. He nodded to himself as their icons appeared on his helmet display. They'd been launched from a stealth ship off the coast. The General Franks was designed to be hard for space-based radar to locate. The low-tech wreckers wouldn't have a clue the ship existed.
20 seconds to impact."
"Heads up, people," Fardell said to his platoon. The 21 other suited figures made gestures of acknowledgement. After 5 years of training and endless live operations against wrecker bases, his troops behaved almost as one. They could see the missile icons as well as he could.
"We move as soon as they hit."
There was limited intelligence on these particular wreckers, although the agencies had been poking them with whatever remote sensors they had. Wrecker factions ranged widely. These ones might be radical Islamicists, independence nuts, eco-terrorists, or just plain criminals. Not knowing what he was about to face made his job harder. Simple fanatics were easy to deal with. It was the ones who thought who could be really dangerous. There were no betraying active emissions from this base, but there rarely were. Active emissions were as good as phoning American forces to say, "Kill us now." But there might have been passive sensors, and if those existed, they'd now be lighting up with warning of the hypersonically incoming missiles. He could almost sense their presence as they screamed through the air. It had taken time and effort to find this particular base, and there was probably a reason the Pentagon wanted it taken intact instead of simply leveled from orbit.
"If they wanted it intact, they shouldn't have sent battle suits," Fardell thought as the first missiles impacted on the base. They were loaded with compressed high explosive. He could feel the ground shake from kilometers away as shockwaves collapsed underground bunkers and fortifications.
Other missiles blasted in, targeting suspected enemy barracks and supply locations. They took no prisoners. Fardell knew that the spooks weren't happy at all about that part of the plan, but the general had put his foot down. He wouldn't risk his men's lives any more than strictly necessary. "Advance," he said to his platoon. Battlesuit regiments had few traditions. They'd been raised in a more practical era. Advancing while shouting battle cries was the mark of fanatics and incompetence. The battlesuits preferred to make their presence known only when their blows landed.
"Aye, Spire, you tracking us?"
"On you, sir,"
Lieutenant Lance Seaman said. The coordinator was the safest man in the platoon, watching the engagement through drones, satellites, and suit sensors from a bunker in Texas. He had detachment, but sometimes the distance that gave him meant he didn't properly understand the situation on the ground. The Pentagon had had to learn hard lessons about leaving tactical decisions to the man on the ground.
"Have you now?" Seaman reported. "Feeding you data."
Most of the information was useless, but Fardell filtered that out with long, practiced ease. He'd been briefed carefully before the insertion into a part of the continent that had once been called Nigeria. That had been 150 years ago, and the continent was a mess. Fardell's own ancestors had been slaves imported from here, and every time duty sent him back to the continent, he couldn't help being grateful to the slavers. Africa was that bad. The city they were heading into had been known by several names since decolonization, and then the collapse, when between disease and warfare, most of the continent's population had been wiped out. Most of the native survivors tended to keep to themselves. But ever since the European-African War and the European occupation of North Africa, Wrecker renegades had used the forbidding empty continent as a base. There were rumors of meaningful civilizations active deeper in inland Africa, but Fardell doubted any of them had much potential. South Africa was advancing north, Europe slowly moving south, and the caliphate growing westwards. It was possible that someday the Wrecker's poisonous refuge would be drained. Until then, he and men like him had the endless task of penetrating the continent, destroying the bases, and getting out. It was hard because the wars had left arms everywhere and made desperate local leaders corrupt, or even more corrupt than they had always been. Few of the legitimate colonies lasted more than 10 years. The illegitimate ones would grow to be troublesome if not dealt with. Since the Los Angeles bioweapon of 20 years ago, the United States government had taken a hard line on them.
"Captain," said Seaman, "I have movement coming down the highway toward you."
100 years ago, the Army would have inserted spotter teams in the area, risking themselves for intelligence. Nowadays, Lieutenant Seaman had robotic flies and butterflies at his disposal to collect information without that risk.
"How many?"
"At least 50, Seaman said. "Older weapons." Legacy weapons, such as the ever-present AK variants, were harmless to the battlesuits. They couldn't penetrate the suit's armor. Small explosives and missiles were a threat, but much less of one than modern missile systems and plasma cannons. Wreckers were often primitive, but they could be surprising. Some groups only had AK-47s, but others had in the past jerry-rigged plasma weapons and would need to be eradicated by orbital strikes. The first thing every trainee learned was that your battle suit didn't make you invincible.
"Sign of anything dangerous?" Fardell asked.
There was a long pause while Seaman focused in on the data.
"Nothing detected."
That wasn't grounds for Fardell to relax. Plasma weapons could be tracked with ease once they'd been activated, but HVMs and mines could be much harder to identify until it was too late.
"Looks like we've been rumbled,"
Lieutenant Browning muttered.
"Must have spotters of their own out here."
The suits spread further apart as they reached the ancient highway, which, despite its condition, showed signs of recent use. Wreckage had been cleared out of the way, and some attempt had been made to fill the worst potholes. He brought up an overview of the developing situation. Supporting elements were already beginning to move toward blocking all possible routes of the ruined city. It was on 22nd Platoon to go in. Well spread out and pausing when they could behind the wrecked vehicles along its side, his people advanced up what had been the highway.
"Lance, send the warning."
A remote drone, old enough to be classed as expendable, had been flying stealthed over the city. Now a voice thundered from it.
"This is the United States Army, operating under the Wrecker protocols."
Fardell could hear it even through his suit from miles away. The Wreckers in the city immediately below its blasting speakers had to be feeling the voice through their very bones.
"You're surrounded and trapped," the deafening voice went on. "Surrender now and you will be treated fairly. Resist and the protocol's enforcement provisions will apply. You have 5 minutes to decide."
Fardell brought up the orbital view, which was limited. The long, ruined city had tens of thousands of places the Wreckers could hide. The Wrecker protocols authorized any country to engage Wreckers to do as they saw fit to them. International law didn't require Wreckers to be given a chance to surrender, or to be treated well if they did. If they did surrender, they'd be resettled to nice penal camps in Antarctica. That might have been why not many of them did. Fardell would personally have rather had more flexible rules of engagement, so more would, but since the nuking of Madrid and the bio attack on L.A., two attacks in 1 year by groups based out of Africa had given the West a harder line on them. Mercy hadn't been an option politically in 2 decades. It was soft on terror. In about 4.5 minutes, Fardell's platoon would go in and shoot anyone they saw. Only rarely would they accept surrenders.
4 minutes, Seaman muttered. There's no sign of any concentrated movement, but one of the spotters heard shots.
Deserters being taken care of, Fardell guessed.
It wasn't unknown for some Wreckers to realize their mistake when faced with real force. Their attempts to surrender could be taken badly by their more fanatical group members. A red alarm flashed across Fardell's visor. Incoming mortar fire. He mouthed a curse as the shells popped up from launchers nearby, rushing into the air to come down amongst the suited platoon. Analytical software was already running. Direct hits from these shells would be nasty, but near misses were likely to be survivable, unless these Wreckers had more tricks. Explosions blasted up among his troops as they spread out, their sensors already probing for the enemy spotters.
"Got them," Seaman reported.
Coordinates appeared in Fardell's visor. A skyscraper that had somehow largely survived decades of neglect and heavy fighting.
"Engage and destroy."
Fardell raised his right arm. Instead of a human-like hand, the suit's right fist was the mouth of a heavy plasma cannon. A stream of blinding white light blasted out from it at the skyscraper, which exploded as the energy impact vaporized parts of it. Streams of explosions detonated amidst the 10-story building as it crumbled. Absently, Fardell realized the Wreckers must have had other explosives in there. His people knew what to do. They advanced at a fast run, faster than an unsuited sprinter could have gone, directly toward the line of major buildings up the road. They'd started to glitter with weapons fire. There were other defenses along the way. Some of Fardell's soldiers swept their plasma cannon along the ground, leaving scorched trails in the knee-high shrubs and vegetation around here, but also detonating nearly a dozen mines.
"Launching HVM strike now," Seaman said.
Icons indicating high-velocity missile launches lit up in Fardell's visor as a drone fired. By now, the U.S. Army had plenty of experience taking down buildings. Everyone that the first fire had come from exploded under the impact of a missile. The suited platoon ran forwards at the speed of galloping horses as the Wreckers launched their own counter-battery fire, desperately hacking at the battlesuits and what drones they could detect with mortars and 20th-century machine guns. Ground-based lasers on the shoulders of some of the platoon activated, turned and flashed as they detonated the incoming shells. Small-caliber bullets started to patter off Fardell's suit with all the impact, to him through the armor, of small hailstones. Wreckers with automatic rifles, mostly young men and many with the glazed eyes and jerky movements that implied battle drugs, ran forwards from what was left of their positions. They sprayed bullets, mostly from the hip, and were cut down by the suited troops. Fardell grimaced, although this was his job. These ones had had no chance, as the commander who'd sent them would have known. Battle drugs did wonders for your aggression, bravery, and pain tolerance, but at the cost of your judgment. These ones' tactics had been obsolete since the First World War, but they'd been too impaired to have a clue. Small explosions blossomed among the platoon as someone further away with an autocannon opened up. As he got the range on the fast-advancing platoon, some of the indicators for Fardell's people began to show minor damage.
"Alert!"
Seaman snapped as a new icon appeared on the display. Instinct took over Fardell's body as he threw himself out of the way before he'd consciously recognized the icon. A plasma blast, a ball of white-green sun stuff contained by magnetic forces, shot past him, close enough to have burned an unsuited human. Instead, it struck Corporal Chester, slightly behind Fardell and to his left.
The captain watched in horror as the suit went pale white and then imploded, burned out by the plasma. Chester hadn't even known what had hit him.
HVM strike on the plasma gun, Fardell snapped. Right the hell now.
The target had been
Sample complete. Ready to continue?